This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Warm greetings from Northwest Germany. My name is Dong Wang, and I'm the hostess for today's interview with Professor Dan Watt at Middlebury College in Vermont about his new book, Slavery in East Asia, published by Cambridge University Press 2022, alongside its twin work, The Blacks of Pre-Modern China, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press over a decade ago. Dan, welcome to my show. I'm so elated that we can do this interview today, August 5th, 2023. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself, Dan?
Okay, Dong, I'm delighted to be with you, and I'm not really sure what might interest your listeners, but I was born in the United States and have always lived here. My original home is the great state of Illinois, so I am a Midwesterner. Illinois, but not Chicago, so I'm from downstate, as we say. My town is called Alton, and it's the first town in Illinois across the river from St. Louis, Missouri. I, from there, moved on as the years moved by to go to college. I ended up in Wisconsin at a small liberal arts college called Beloit. And that was a transformative experience in the sense that it was really there that my interest in China was kindled. I was a student of philosophy, chiefly Western philosophy. But in my sort of discursive time, I encountered some translations of classical thinkers in the Chinese tradition, Lun Yu of Confucius, Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu, and various other thinkers, and found them intriguing in the sense that they tended to have very different answers for the same basic questions that were posed by Western philosophers. And I guess from there, I decided, I don't know, I'm a reasonably intelligent person, so there's no need for me to be at the mercy of these translations. So in the attempt to narrow the distance between these thinkers and myself, I embarked on a study of the Chinese language. The programs in those days were not as formal and established. I had to cobble together a lot independently, but eventually I moved on. And after college, relocated to New England, where I have lived longer than any other place in my life, entered graduate school at Harvard University and had an exceptional experience there, great mentors. I was fortunate enough on entering to have a course with the late, great John Fairbank, and my own distinguished mentor was Benjamin Schwartz. And I learned a lot. I think I've been able to apply it. And I think I've probably taken up enough of your time describing my early background. And I hope that suffices.
Thank you, Dan. This is wonderful because I actually many, many years ago, have been to Beloit College. So I know where you were. Yeah.
Oh, my.
One summer, I was teaching there. So I had very fond memories of the place. And of course, it was quite easy to go to Chicago or to go to
Madison.
Yes, from Beloit, which I did. So
well, that's fantastic, Doom.
Yeah, so wonderful to know where you were. And of course, it all helped me understand why your earlier work focuses Shaoyun, that very prominent earlier Song Dynasty's philosopher, and of course, kind of my hometown compatriot, or whatever one would like to define the place.
Are you from Luoyang?
Yes, I was. I was born there. Both my parents actually also are locals and city dwellers. So I spent the first of my 16 years of life in Luoyang before I went to college.
That's fantastic. Coincidence.
Yeah, so lovely to know that I was able to read your great work earlier on. I believe it was your book on Shaoyun was published in the 1990s.
1996.
Yeah, I was so delighted actually to meet you in person finally this year after citing you and studying your work. Okay, great, Don. Now, you know, you've taken on kind of different topics, although I think you stay in the similar time frame, the pre-modern periods. So let's talk about your new topics. Probably for you, it's no longer new, but I'm curious, many folks, I think, probably tend to link slavery only to the United States and Europe. On the other hand, for those of us specialists dealing with historical documents such as the Qing China, we also know that the Qing Mandarins of different ethnicity were inclined to address themselves as your slaves in their official correspondence or memorials to the emperors. This is not that unusual, even for European systems at the same time, where feudal servility literally demanded that the underlings declare themselves to be subjecting themselves as slaves to their masters. In the 19th century, such formulas, such as also in Russia, was still in wide use. So, Don, could you clarify terms like slavery, slaves, the blacks, East Asian, pre-modern, and medieval, as defined in your tome books?
Well, thank you for the question. To address the Chinese case, which is, of course, the one that I know best, I think what is crucial is you're stating that these forms of deprecatory self-address were commonplace in ministerial correspondence dispatched to emperor. In doing so, you focused on one of the many protocols that were at very heart of what we later have come to refer to as Chinese imperial autocracy. The trend toward autocracy had probably been present since the establishment of the empire, but there's no question that is most closely identified with the late imperial era of the Ming and Qing dynasties, or at any rate, the post-Yuan period, when ministers seem to have consistently had different relations, to have had a categorically different relationship with their sovereigns than in the past. And this relationship was one that was much more servile and largely at the capricious whims of the monarch. With regard to terminology, yes, you are correct. that such self-denigrating terms were used. But with etymology, again, to refer to language always being ever revealing, we find even terms we regard today as relatively neutral have demeaning histories. A very good and very interesting and very common example of what I mean by this is the commonplace term chun, meaning minister or servant. And this term is clearly a pictograph which evolved to become an ideograph. If you look at it and have the knowledgeable enough background, we can see that it is a downturned eye, consequently signifying that this person should not look sovereign in the face and maintain a kind of servile and dependent relationship with the monarch. This sort of relationship in which there was a great imbalance between the sovereign and the minister was one that even modern commentators like Liang Qichao referred to as one of the key detriments to progress, political progress in China, because this relationship was ill-suited for moving forward for China's political progress. And he stated that this type of relationship between monarch and minister had to change in order for China to move forward. You asked me about a litany of terms as well, how I would define them. As for slavery, slaves, the blacks, East Asia, pre-modern and medieval, I would say that my own treatment of these terms, at least in the writing, is rather unexceptional to what people might expect. I think the one term that you targeted that probably deserves greater attention is the blacks, because as I generally have to do in nearly every instance is remind readers and in lectures, remind audiences that we should not immediately think of the blacks I'm referring to as Africans or peoples of African descent. In fact, in the Chinese context, this medieval or pre-modern context, these individuals were typically Malay peoples of Southeast Asian extraction. And it's only after a significant passage of time that we can make the argument for Africanized individuals as blacks in China. I hope that answers, at least in part, what was a very expansive question.
I appreciate your informing the listeners about particularly the historical context for the peoples being called black. They could mean very differently, very widely, actually, in the pre-modern and medieval China. Thank you. I'd like to ask you more along this line. We are all historians. So for me, I have been studying history for 40 years by now. So I would say your recent work presents a giant step further in treating East Asia, especially China, equally as part of world history through examining universal historical themes and human practices and institutions, such as enslavement, slavery, racism, and anti-racism in their regional and local contexts and attributes. That yields a fascinating revelation. So as you know, these issues are not rationally reflected in most state-controlled historiography. This dimension of historical realities needs to be continuously unraveled through all inclusive historical sources. I would imagine it was a labor of love for you, driven not only by our own professional intellectual curiosity, but also professional and civic duty. I wonder if you can share your experiences of handling primary and secondary sources with particular attention to historical and ethnic circumstances. May I ask you, did you really ever feel sometimes really uncomfortable or not so sure whether the topics we are discussing today were really hugely significant and important?
Wow. Well, thank you for yet another important question. And I can only begin to answer by saying that when dealing with the histories of interactions of great varieties of peoples, but having the circumstance of the records of those interactions being available in the language of only one of those peoples, in this case, classical or literary Chinese, necessity for striving to be a judicious mediator as well as an interpreter with even-handedness is profound, even if it is not entirely always achievable. I think I was first struck by the gravity of this situation, this responsibility, really, when writing The Blacks of Pre-Modern China, trying to figure out a way to have sensitivity to those who could not speak for themselves, given that the records were inevitably in the voices of those who, in many occasions, were the oppressors. It's a difficult circumstance to be in, but I think once I found myself in it, the only way out was to keep going. And in the process, I gave considerable thought to the project as being one of managing to give voices to the voiceless and figuring out a way to bring people who had been marginalized in history more to the forefront, more toward the center. And consequently, if anything, I came to feel that the project actually grew in importance for me over time. And I really didn't expect to be as ensnared and engaged in it as I eventually became. I'm not really sure if I've answered your question with complete adequateness, but I very much appreciate your asking it because it is something that I've wrestled with and in fact still continue to wrestle with now. But with the passage of time, it's become an increasingly familiar combatant, and consequently, I think I've been able to surmount the challenge at least on a few occasions, but certainly not all of them.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Thank you so much for sharing these experiences. Now, regarding the origins of slavery in pre-modern and medieval China, Korea, Japan, and Vietnam, I have been pondering your thought-provoking argument that, I quote you here, war assuredly remained the prime impetus behind slavery throughout pre-modern history, up to and throughout most, if not all, of the medieval age, end quote. When researching for my own book on Luoyang's Longmen Grottoes and Cultural Heritage, I came across historical records from the 6th century CE that large numbers of those defeated Shang Dynasty's descendants were forced to relocate to a particular district in Luoyang, an ancient capital of China, around the 11th century BCE during the Western Zhou Dynasty, subsequently the Eastern Zhou, Yet, 1.5 millennium afterwards, their descendants are still living in the state of servitude in the very same neighborhood of Luoyang, was still considered by the elites, the person who wrote that 6th century's book I read. So at the time, the earlier descendants of the Shang people, they were still considered the Shang remnants. I'm quoting the 6th century, that author. So these people occupying the lowest status of social, political, and economic hierarchy under the so-called non-Chinese Tuoba rule in the very cradle of the so-called Chinese civilization. We know that well before the Common Era, East Asia was already a diverse place populated by people of widely different groups, races, and peoples. So why was there continued forced migration and trafficking of both East Asians as well as of Africans and native Southeast Asians? Historically, you know, you also reviewed the name, you know, Kunlun or Heifen, Heigui and Heinu, etc., across pre-modern and medieval China, perhaps Korea, Japan, and Vietnam. Because I'm asking this question is that I'm also thinking of the People's Republic of China, the PRC, because we know that on paper, the Chinese Communist Party promoted and still promotes the kind of what they would call the whole process, democracy. But in reality, we know that ever since the beginning of the PRC, there were all different classes of people, you know, when actually the people were supposed to be liberated in the so-called New China ever since 1949. And yet, in the meantime, the Chinese people themselves have been divided either by class, by their familial background, or by situation. For example, if one was unfortunate or is unfortunate to be born in the countryside, then means their social status, their registration, important registration status would be forever labeled as the class very inferior, even though gradually there have been some kind of channels opened, but it has to be fought by them. And then, of course, these days in the city, the very issue of the kind of the citizenship or the rights, who would get that, are still a huge ongoing issue, means that people are not equal at all. This is the institutionalized inequality. So now, Dong, how would you...
the stigma of the hukou.
Yeah, how would you, you know, what is your thoughts on the sustained and... kind of the situation, internal and also external inequality?
Okay. Thank you. Again, a kind of complex question, but let me see if we can cut through to some answers. Addressing questions predominantly from the Chinese cultural arena, which was the primary venue in which such exogenous enslavement, that is the enslavement of foreign peoples, variously defined, took place. The longevity of the practice was surely facilitated by changes in the law, specifically under the famous Tang Code, the Tang Lu, instituted over the course of the 620s to the 650s. With respect to slavery, a conspicuous imposition of the code is that it became illegal to enslave any free Chinese commoner on pain of execution by strangulation. Needless to say, this provision led to a sharp shrinking in the endogenous pool of persons potentially subjectable to enslavement. However, this same provision had the collateral effect of intensifying and expanding the market for exogenous slaves, with these peoples that you have mentioned, Africans and native Southeast Asians, historically Kunlun, Haifan, Hegwe, Huenu, becoming targeted as prime prospective enslavement possibilities. And this had a way of perpetuating the tradition well beyond the period in which this transformation took place. Consequently, this was a real change also, I think, because the Tang Code was similarly influential in Korea, in Japan, and to a somewhat lesser degree, but also in Vietnam. But I think that helps to account for the fact that long after the subjugation of native Chinese to enslavement had begun to subside, there was continued profiteering in the enslavement under other non-Chinese individuals. They were targeted as prime prospects, I think, for centuries.
Yeah, thank you, Dong. You made a powerful statement in your 2022 book. I quote you here. War as the wellspring and mainspring of slavery, bondage, and human trafficking is unique neither to East Asia nor to the medieval period of history. Yet the fact that a mode of institutionalized subjugating might even have been globally shared and subscribed to hardly diminishes its overarching and overbearing significance as the presumptive operational enslavement framework that was so perniciously imposed on untold numbers of individuals across the medieval East Asian world, which had no defense against it, to regard it as anything less and estimates the enormities of its debilitating scope and depth. Devaluing its singularity results only in disservice to the legacies of the countless medieval East Asian minions whose lives, liberties, and aspirations, oftentimes from birth, were so summarily oppressed and unforgivingly crushed by it, end quote. So what was peculiar and universal about slavery in East Asia, Dong?
Probably the fact that because it was never strictly racially based, as became the case in Europe and certainly later in the Americas and the United States, slavery's durability in East Asia is accompanied by a kind of invisibility. The institution itself was not as easily detectable or discernible as in the West, largely because it was not constrained by racial priorities. Universal, certainly for the medieval period, and that by my usage is the 6th through the 16th century of the Common Era, or was the undisputed generator of slavery. This phenomenon, this dynamic with war serving as a sort of facilitator, even the handmaiden of slavery, is a process that really linked very closely with slavery as it was practiced in the medieval West. I hope I've answered your question.
Yeah, thank you. It's very helpful. Well, I'm going to actually to continue actually along the line because as I understand, really like racism or slavery were not institutionally or intellectually reflected yet, particularly I would think in the context of China. It's only just lately we know that what happened to, for example, the Manchus at the turn of the 20th century. In my own new book on Xi Chantai, as a part of a joint effort to uncover those lost voices, as you are doing actually in history, I wrote that, I'm quoting myself here, notions of racial purity, oneness, unity as devotion to God prevalent in the Australian Federation were toward the end of Qing China from 1644 to 1911-1912, matched by many Chinese radicals at the time in the form of racial pronouncements that singled the Manchus out as the other race who usurped a pure Chinese dynasty, the Ming, from 1368 to 1644. Racism of this sort held the Manchus solely culpable for China's modern backwardness, and therefore it aimed to annihilate them in an effort to restore pristine China. This version of racial purity is as clearly expressed in Sun Yat-sen's revolutionary slogan, quoting here, "Expel the Tatars means the Manchus and restore China," end quote, as it was in Xie's 1924 account of the 1911 revolution. And of course, Xi Chantai's racist perceptions extended to the black people as well. I'm not going to quote what Xie wrote at the time, but then is to continue our conversation on this. It's do you know how and what have the historical facts of internal and external slavery and racism been reflected in, for example, Chinese historiography? Has it been?
Well, Chinese historiography on the subject of slavery, generally, whether considering it internal or external, has been and largely continues to be influenced by influence, I use a polite word, has been influenced by the overlay of Marxism. And by this, I mean the controversial thesis advanced of a slave society, Guo Moruo, and his writings. Interesting to note that he based himself on research that he had originally reviewed in the 20s, but continued to adjust and revise through the 1940s and early 1950s. In Korean and Japanese or in Vietnamese historiographies, wherein slavery, when it is broached, has been rightly treated as a mostly native phenomenon, internal phenomenon, the folk has been on slavery as a system of native exploitation, with questions of racism, therefore, somewhat understandably, rarely being addressed. However, while I'm an optimist, I'm really not. I think there's actually good reason to anticipate new research in this direction beginning to emerge.
Yeah,
I've met a few promising grad students who are going to take the gauntlet and move it, take the ball and move it further toward the goalpost.
Yeah, indeed. And thank you very much for sharing your viewpoints. As far as I know, because I have been doing quite a lot of reading of the 19th and of course 20th and 21st centuries history books, and very often I feel the historical topics such as slavery and racism, like for example in the PRC, are like somebody else's problems. It's like only the United States problem. So That is the predominating kind of theme. If ever there is any work written rationally in the history of slavery, that would be the United States problem. So that there is not much one would ever think, is there any reflection on the part of the Chinese language historiography to really to unravel those hidden histories actually on the same topics. So I appreciate your sharing your research findings. Now, Don, would you be able to speak about the lingering and new forms of spoken and unspoken prejudices against the Blacks in East Asia and against each other among quite some Asians in Asia and in other places of the world? It's an uncomfortable topic, we must say that. But we have seen some reports, for example, about the Black community in the Guangzhou, the Canton area. This is, we're talking about even during the COVID, their experiences and other similar reports. Then also, in the meantime, we also know that there have been Afro-Asian solidarity movements, we could say dating back to probably the early and mid 20th century from and onwards to our own time as well. So would you be able to share your take on what the agencies and drivers for such a reality were and are?
Well, since it involves the contemporary situation, this might be the most challenging of your questions of all, but let me give it a stab. On the one hand, East Asian prejudice against Blacks has age-old roots and yet contemporary triggers, just as discord between various Asian groups, for instance, Chinese versus Japanese, and so forth and so on. On the other hand, I think there are some very salient contemporary developments that have influenced this type of friction. And the one thing I think I can point to that probably will not raise too much dispute on the part of others is simply the fact that there's been a rather striking and overt rise of authoritarianism in the political sphere across both Western and Asian nations. And I think whenever you see authoritarianism rise, you see the rights minorities suffer. And you see minorities become subject to victimization. And without being overly specific about that, I think most people know the sorts of political actors and the actions that they are driving. I think most people know the personalities that I have in mind with regard to this. Again, I'm not much of an optimist, but as you yourself stated, there have been longstanding movements, Afro-Asian solidarity, and particularly, I think, in the academic spheres, these sorts of alliances hold much promise for the future, and they are empowered largely as educational vehicles. Part of their mission is to combat prejudice, and as long as probably inhabit the earth, there's probably going to be prejudice and inequality, but hopefully, as long as we inhabit the earth, there's also going to be movement towards solidarity and people willing to stand up, to put sometimes their lives on the line to bend us toward the arc of justice.
Thank you. That is a positive note, Dong. As you may know, I'm also optimist. So I also believe in human progress. So let's hope societies can become better for the majority and, of course, the minority peoples. So now, may I ask you, we have taken up a lot of your time. May I ask you, what are you working on professionally these days?
The first matter of business is that I am at work and completing a second Cambridge element, this time more, I guess, in terms of subject matter, more mainstream, that being a text on Tung China and the world. So again, I continue to inhabit this important, crucial period between the 10th and the 13th centuries of the Common Era. I'm also working as a set editor on an important new series called The Medieval World by Bloomsbury Publishing. It's going to result in 4 volumes, globally balanced, involving the important theme of ethnicity and race. And it's a long-term project, I guess, because it involves many people, many personalities, but it's moving ahead. And I continue to work, among other things, on a project, sort of long-term, sort of summary statement on foreign slaves in China. And this, in addition to a rash of other things that I won't take up your time dwelling on, but I have managed to continue to stay active. And having a few more things that I still have left to say, I'll try to continue in that vein.
Thank you. These projects sound exciting, and I'm looking forward to reading more of your work, Dong.
Well, thank you, Dong.
And thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Particularly, this is actually a weekend. So I appreciate your sharing the great insights with the audience around the world.
Well, I appreciate your making time for me. It's a weekend for you, too. Been a real pleasure to reflect on these few things that I have accomplished, and I'm delighted that my production is generating at least some interest. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. So long for now.
All right. And so long for now. And here's to our future continued communication.